This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, July 26, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the trial of Army Private Bradley Manning winds down with closing arguments and a decision expected soon. Halliburton admits to destroying evidence related to the 2010 BP oil spill as environmentalists demand stricter government oversight. And we'll take a look at the story behind that plate of shrimp or seafood at your local restaurant. It may have come from Thailand, where migrant workers are fighting to improve conditions at thousands of seafood factories. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Mass rallies and protests erupted across Egypt today. Military leaders issued a call earlier this week asking that Egyptians supporting their actions turn out and give them a mandate to continue. Muslim Brotherhood supporters also came out after hearing news that deposed President Mohamed Morsi is being investigated on charges of espionage and murder for allegedly conspiring with Hamas during the 2011 revolution that brought down Hosni Mubarak. Video shows thousands of military supporters in Tahrir Square waving Egyptian flags. Many more gathered in another Cairo square, waving posters showing the ex-president. International media reports some clashes between protester groups have broken out. The government says at least two people are dead. Amidst continuing outrage over the acquittal of George Zimmerman for the death of Florida teenager Trayvon Martin, human and civil rights groups in Florida are continuing a multi-day walk for dignity. Marchers were in Daytona today. They're using the civil action to continue a call for justice for Martin. They also want the resignation of the Florida Attorney General and the release of Marissa Alexander, an African-American woman who was sentenced to 20 years for firing a gun but not hitting anyone during a domestic disturbance. Activists are using that case to point out disparities in sentencing. One marcher said the manner in which justice has been meted out is symbolic of a state that is closing in on itself.
And taking it out on our brothers and sisters who are the most abandoned by this society. It's reminiscent of what happened during Katrina, and it's all part of the same thing. We're here to set the basis for a new world.
The march will conclude tomorrow in Sanford. About 20 participants have been walking through communities along the North Florida coast, holding assemblies along the way. The hunger strike by California prisoners is nearing the end of its third week. Inmates in 11 prisons are protesting long-term solitary confinement and poor prison conditions. The number of striking prisoners, at one time 30,000 according to advocates, has now dipped to around 650. At issue is the widespread use of segregated housing units for prisoners in long-term solitary confinement. Laura Magnani with American Friends Service Committee says 15 days is considered the maximum time in the tiny windowless cells, yet the average stay is 6 years.
They could be allowed time with other people. They could be allowed visits with family on a regular basis, phone calls with family on a regular basis, and access to programs. Those kinds of things would go a long way.
The LA Times reports 16 striking inmates are currently receiving medical care. Prison officials have called the hunger strike a mass disturbance that's being organized by prison gangs. Magnani says the conditions qualify as torture.
It's important that people recognize that this is a very courageous, highly venerated, nonviolent practice that they've adopted. Instead, the prison tends to treat it like a disturbance and to punish the people who are on hunger strike.
Advocates for the inmates met with prison officials earlier this week, but Magnani says officials didn't show any willingness to budge. A letter from the assistant director of the FBI reveals the agency has used surveillance drones over U.S. territory 10 times in the past 7 years. In a letter to Republican Senator Rand Paul, the FBI says drones were used 8 times during criminal investigations and twice for national security cases. Paul raised concerns about the use of domestic drones during a filibuster of the nomination of CIA head John Brennan in March.
I will speak today until the president responds and says, no, we won't kill Americans in cafes. No, we won't kill you at home in your bed at night. No, we won't drop bombs on restaurants. Is that so hard?
Paul says he requested the information about domestic drone use last month. The FBI issued two responses, one classified and one not, and Paul publicized the non-classified letter yesterday. The FBI says none of the 10 drone flights were armed and that drones are not used to conduct bulk domestic surveillance. And finally, the Obama administration announced today two prisoners held at Guantanamo Bay will be repatriated to Algeria. These would be the first Guantanamo inmates to be transferred out of the detention facility this year. In the announcement, the administration included a call on Congress to lift restrictions, making it difficult to transfer inmates. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Halliburton has agreed to plead guilty to destroying evidence related to the 2010 BP oil spill, which killed 11 people and caused widespread damage to the ecosystem of the Gulf Coast. The Justice Department filed the plea deal in the U.S. District Court of Louisiana Thursday. The deal forces Halliburton to admit its criminal conduct as a misdemeanor, pay a $200,000 fine, and be on probation for 3 years. Environmentalists and advocates for corporate accountability are panning the deal as a slap on the wrist and are demanding the government better regulate corporations in the oil industry. In Washington, D.C., FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
More than 100 environmental activists gathered in downtown D.C. on Friday to speak out against the government agencies who approve what they call extreme energy projects and the corporations that profit off of fossil fuels.
The corporations are pretty much having their run of the government, from the state level in North Carolina, where I'm coming from, all the way to the U.S. Congress. Corporations write the laws.
That's father and environmental organizer Greg Yost. He and dozens of others from around the country arrived in D.C. this week after marching more than 100 miles from Maryland's Camp David. The Walk for Our Grandchildren aimed to raise awareness around climate change and fossil fuels that contribute to it and pressure President Obama to better regulate coal, oil, and gas corporations.
When the corporations write the laws, they dig as much as they want, they move it around as much as they want, they burn all they want, they make a whole lot of money, and meanwhile the planet gets sicker and sicker.
The action came less than 24 hours after the Justice Department announced that Halliburton, a company with deep financial ties to the U.S. government, will get a plea deal for its role in one of the worst environmental disasters in U.S. history, the 2010 Gulf oil spill. In a deal pending court approval, it will agree to plead guilty to destroying assessments it gave to BP on how to construct the drilling rig that blew up that April. It will pay the maximum allowable fine of $200,000. Nick Stracco, a student at Tulane University in New Orleans who came to D.C. for this week's protest, said the punishment is not enough to deter more criminal behavior in the future.
I think the imbalance of how we hold corporate criminals accountable is completely unjust. And these companies are so big, they just have so much money. And so these fines can be huge, but when compared to the profits that these companies make, they still just have so much money and it won't be that much of an impact on their bottom line.
Halliburton, BP, and Transocean still face civil charges for the damage caused by the spill. That trial will resume this September in New Orleans. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Today, the defense for Army Private Bradley Manning gave closing arguments before a military judge at Fort Meade, Maryland. Manning faces 22 charges for leaking military and government documents to WikiLeaks. One of those charges is aiding the enemy, which could bring life in prison. And much of the final arguments centered on this charge. For more, we're joined by journalist Kevin Gostola. He's one of the few reporters who has been covering the trial daily. He's posting updates on FireDogLake.com. Kevin, welcome back to FSRN.
Thank you for having me.
Today, the defense presented its closing argument, and some of it is in response to the prosecution. So I want to first ask about the government's case that wrapped up yesterday. The prosecution used the terms anarchist, hacker, and traitor to describe Manning. What case did they lay out yesterday?
First, I just want to emphasize that it was the first time that we heard from any prosecutor the word traitor to describe what Bradley Manning did. In their case, they, for their closing argument, laid out each piece of information that Manning had disclosed without authorization and explained how they felt that disclosure went to the committing of offenses. They also spent a portion of the closing argument assassinating the character of Bradley Manning. It did not seem like enough for them to just present the charges. They also wanted to disprove, as best as they thought they could, what the defense had said previously about how he might be a whistleblower, might be a good-intentioned soldier who wanted to spark change and reform. They twisted some of his words to use them against him, and they called him an anarchist. They called him a hacker, and they were very direct about attacking his patriotism, suggesting that he had been disloyal to the United States, saying that he broke rank with the nation. And so this is where they took it. They took it to this level, and we hadn't seen it at this level before, but it was the note that they seemed to want to end on with their closing argument.
So today, Manning's defense then presented its closing arguments, responding to some of the prosecution's cases. You're describing essentially a character assassination against Manning. What has defense attorney David Coombs focused on today?
He opened up with the words on a PowerPoint presentation, the truth. And maybe it sounds kind of silly, but he really wanted to bring it back to what the facts are in the case, as he happens to understand them. And so representing Manning, he went through the a slide presentation. First, he did a section of his presentation just on the government's theory and how it doesn't add up, where there are inconsistencies. How one of the things they argued in the prosecution's case was that Manning wanted notoriety and fame. But then at the same time, they said he wanted to remain anonymous when he was on his computers. Clearly, you can't have it both ways. You're going to get caught because it's just the whole thing is going to break down. You can't do both.
Coombs also played clips today from the collateral damage video. That's the military video that shows U.S. Apache helicopters firing on unarmed civilians and children in Iraq in 2007. Why did he show this?
Coombs showed the video because it's one of the more powerful examples for why Manning began to make decisions about releasing information. He walked through some of the moments in his deployment that inspired him to be what he said was a whistleblower. And I'm basically paraphrasing a lot of what the defense did, because as these clips were playing, they didn't just play out. The defense, David Coombs, was adding a narration to these clips as they were playing. And I think it was a pretty remarkable moment in the closing argument today.
Kevin Gustola, the court says a ruling could come anytime after arguments have wrapped up. Could be this weekend, could be next week. We've been checking in with you throughout the trial, and some days there have been as few as 3 reporters. This week there have been as many as 50 or more. Quickly, what is the security and atmosphere like there?
At the trial, we've had an escalation of security. We now, when we go into the media center, have to be inspected. They move a wand up and down our bodies. They go through our bags. They have us take out all of our items and lay them out in front of them so they can pick over and inspect them. Yesterday, there were armed military police officers roaming the aisles, walking behind us, snooping over our shoulder. I was told not to have Twitter windows open on my computer, not to have any internet windows open on my computer later in the afternoon. And so it has escalated. The people here who are running and doing media, handling the media as part of the military, are getting orders from the judge to be very strict and no longer lenient toward the press, and that's creating a lot of conflicts. And that, unfortunately, is becoming a part of the Manning court-martial story.
Journalist Kevin Gostola at the Bradley Manning court-martial at Fort Meade, Maryland, where the defense presented its closing argument today. You can find more coverage from Kevin at firedoglake.com. Kevin Gostola, thanks as always.
Thanks, Dorian.
Advocacy groups are calling on Nigerian authorities to improve their response to survivors of sexual abuse. They say sexual assaults cut across age groups and socioeconomic status, but the situation appears worse among children. Human rights activists are also noting that a new troubling trend is emerging: children abusing other children. They're seeking better ways to help survivors find justice. FSRN's Samuel Okocha reports.
According to Nigeria's National Human Rights Commission, 33% of reported cases of sexual violence are against children. But advocacy groups believe many cases go unreported because of a low level of awareness and stigmatization. Many parents don't learn of the abuse right away, as was the case for Bridget Ken, whose name we've changed to protect her identity. A mother of six, she's a petty trader who lives in Ajegunle, a suburb in Nigeria's commercial capital, Lagos. For several months, Ken says her youngest child, Stephen, also not his real name, was sexually abused in the family's home.
I almost fainted. I said, sorry, this is what he has been doing for almost 3 months.
The abuser was a member of the community who would come to use their toilets.
He would just come, he'd say, Mama, won't go toilet. I will not tell my son to go and fetch water for him. But I know there was a day my son saw that man coming. Now I started running at my back, saying, Mommy, this guy is coming again, he's coming again.
Over time, the boy grew sick and the family became worried. One day, the boy recounted how he was being assaulted. The mother reported the attacks to the police and the abuser was arrested. But it took more than 2 years before the accused was convicted and put behind bars. Frustrated with the slow process of seeking justice for our abused son, a friend introduced Ken to the Child Dignity Foundation, an advocacy group involved in helping child survivors of sexual abuse get legal help and other forms of assistance. Amaka Nwogo works with the organization and says the first thing the group did was take care of the boy's health.
You could see there was something just not right and still wrong with the child. And we thought, while you are going through this, because this child's health is paramount, we don't know what this child has. So we referred them to teaching hospital here in Ikeja, which we had to bring money for the test and stuff like that. So they had to do pretty much antibiotics and infection they needed to treat and stuff. And still referred him back to the clinic closer to them to continue treatment and everything they were doing with the boy. So, and it got better. Like, you see him now, he's looking better, everything looking okay, even the skin.
Because of stigmatization, many sexual abuse survivors don't report the crimes or seek help. But according to Nwogo, the situation appears to be changing.
People are beginning to stick out their guts, that no matter what it takes, I'm going to say it out. Parents are beginning to understand, we need to stop this, because if you don't say it out, that same person might go out getting the next victim, and it might even be somebody you know.
Advocacy groups say cases of sexual abuse go beyond adults abusing children. They say they are hearing more reports of children sexually abusing other children.
There was a gang rape that the youngest was 10, that organized to rape a girl in the graveyard. So it's a problem.
That's Princess Olufemi Kayode of Media Concern Initiative, an NGO that works to prevent and respond to cases of sexual abuse among children. She says the issue of child-on-child sexual assaults calls for serious concern.
This is bigger than adult abuse, and I'm praying that it's something Nigeria will begin to look into. And how do we really, really stop this and get the children that is happening to speak out?
Media Concern Initiative recently organized a forum to raise awareness about the issues involved in child sexual abuse. At the event, advocacy groups called on government agencies and communities to be more responsive in dealing with cases of sexual abuse against children. Dr. Michael Dibogo works with Hope Worldwide Nigeria, an NGO involved in child protection.
Communities need to be able to stand and say if there is a case of an abused, the community must stand and protect the child, not the abuser.
Advocacy groups say most of the sexual abuse against children are committed by people familiar in the community or even family members. Dibogo says prevention remains critical to stemming the problem.
Our work also deals with economically empowering them, creating the opportunities of accessing microcredit for them, because a lot of times when people don't have that financial base, then they are vulnerable to exploitation. So our work is around reducing the exploitation of the vulnerable and empowering the vulnerable to be able to identify the possible risk within their environment.
For children who become victims of sexual abuse, Kayode says her group, Media Consent Initiative, works with the criminal justice system to train personnel on how to reduce trauma for survivors. They also run a rape crisis center.
The model we run is basically the one that has victim advocates, has helplines. Now we can do HCT here. We can do HIV counseling and testing almost immediately. And if there is need for somebody to get post-exposure prophylaxis, they can get it here.
Nigeria's National Human Rights Commission helps survivors of sexual abuse to seek redress in the courts. But our coordinator with the commission, Mausi Shagun, says imprisonment of the abuser isn't enough.
As far as I am concerned, if the material possessions of the offender, once the person has been convicted, can be sold to meet some of the, at least some financial needs of the victim, we will be assuring the individual of better justice and the cost of coming out.
Shagun says sexual assault affects people of all ages and socioeconomic status in Nigeria, but adds that children form the most vulnerable group. To empower children, she says her commission organizes programs in schools to build the capacity of children to respond to sexual violence. Samuel Okocha, FSRN, Lagos.
Thailand's seafood industry has come under fire after several reports have surfaced alleging the forced detention and extortion of workers, along with the use of child labor. The Thai government has failed to stop and prevent these abuses. Many who make up the workforce in the canning plants and seafood factories are migrants from Myanmar, the nearby country also known as Burma. And as FSRN's Simba Russo reports, they're fighting to improve labor conditions.
27-year-old Win Sain is from Tanintharyi Division in southeast Myanmar. Win Sain is among the countless Burmese migrants fleeing the crippling economy, the lack of job opportunities, and the inability to meet daily basic needs for survival in their home country.
I had a dream that if I came to Thailand to work, then I could save enough money to rebuild our house back in Burma.
He came to Thailand in 2006 after paying a Burmese broker about $23 to travel across the border. After a month of no money and relying on his sister, who was already working in Thailand, Win Sain found himself at Tuna Canning Factory Thai Union in Mahachai.
I had to use money for everyday living expenses, like paying for the room, food, and paying back the broker as well as the passport. So I could not save enough money to send back.
One of Thailand's central provinces, Samut Sakhon, or modern Mahachai, is home to over 6,000 seafood factories, according to labor rights activists interviewed by FSRN. They say an estimated 200,000 migrants work in this fishing and factory town, located at the mouth of the Tha Chin Klong River. Between 1.8 and 3 million migrants work in Thailand, according to Human Rights Watch, and one of them is Yuong Jo, who came here in 1998. He also found work in a seafood factory. It was there that he says he witnessed a lot of violations, such as non-payment of wages, long overtime hours, dangerous and unsanitary work environments, and in some cases, physical abuse.
Educating the workers took a lot of time because many were afraid of claiming their rights due to lack of documents or fear of abuse or mistreatment from their employers. The small factories are regulated by individual owners, and they are aware of everything happening in the factories. If someone tried to claim their rights, they then would either report you to the police or send their gangs to deal with you. Many people were beaten. In the beginning, I contacted Rock Thai, which promotes healthcare in Mahachai. Then I found out about the Labor Rights Promotion Network and started working with them. I would go every week to their office and get information about labor laws and report any problems experienced by the workers. I also started working with the Human Rights and Development Foundation to protect the workers' rights.
Yuong Jo is now the president of the Migrant Workers' Rights Network, a Burmese-led grassroots organization which works for the rights of migrant labor, systematically exposing the violations they are subjected to. On Sundays, the Rights Network's office, which houses a library and learning center, comes to life as Burmese migrants opt to spend their only day off as volunteers working to further migrant issues. Again, Yuong Jo.
Many migrants face dire economic conditions back in Myanmar, so they couldn't complete or further their education. So the idea of the library is that when they read more books, then they gain more knowledge. We provide educational services like computer, Thai, and English classes while they're working in Thailand, so that when they go back to Myanmar, they'll have more skills. It's a form of empowerment.
Recently, Myanmar's labor minister, Yu Myaw Myint, expressed concerns over allegations that Thai authorities were extorting money from migrant workers, regardless of whether or not they held legal passports. For migrants like 27-year-old Sumo Jo from Mandalay, it's time that the government create more jobs at home.
If I could speak to the Burmese government, I would say create jobs for the people. The government should create a minimum wage law. Right now, women make about $1 a day, men about $1.60 per day. Make a labor production law and increase wages that are fair enough that people can really live and survive in our country.
In May, the Migrant Workers' Rights Network was awarded the International Labor Rights Award by the International Labor Rights Forum in Washington, D.C. The honor gives the organization global recognition as a representative of migrant workers on issues relating to trafficking, forced labor, and other abuses in Thailand. Simba Rousseau, Free Speech Radio News, Mahachai, Thailand.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Molly Stentz and Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Carla West. Our theme music was composed and produced by Alan Weatherhead. Teddy Wilson manages our Tumblr page, where you can find sights and sounds from FSRN's global reporters. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org. And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.